Welcome to the Open House podcast site, available at theopenhouse.net.au blog site.
Well, for years, Anne Rice was the queen of dark supernatural stories, the atheist behind Interview with a Vampire and other well-known gothic works. So what's a vampire writer with 100 million books in print doing writing about Jesus? Well, the answer is a story in itself, even before we get to her fictionalized accounts of Jesus' life and work. Anne Rice, really been looking forward to our conversation. Thanks so much for joining us on Open House.
Oh, I'm absolutely delighted.
I've got to read a little bit from the latest book, The Road to Cana. Is it possible that Christ the Lord is a carpenter in the town of Nazareth, a man past 30 years of age, and one of a family of carpenters, a family of men and women and children that fill 10 rooms of an ancient house, and that in this winter of no rain, of endless dust, of talk of trouble in Judea, Christ the Lord sleeps in a worn woolen robe, in a room with other men, beside a smoking brazier? Is it possible that in that room, asleep, he dreams? Yes, I know it's possible. I am Christ the Lord. I know. What I must know, I know. What I must learn, I learn. And in this skin, I live and sweat and breathe and groan. Beautiful work, and obviously it's gotten you quite acclaim. It's a long way from Interview with a Vampire, though, isn't it?
It is. It's a very long way, but you know, it's all been one long journey, one long quest.
Yes.
I've been very, very blessed in that regard, I think, that I learned a lot along the way writing those other books, and when I turned to the Lord, a lot of that craft and skill or whatever mercifully I'd been allowed to acquire, it's been something I've been able to use.
Mm. Well, let's go back, 28 novels and counting, plus historical works and more. Which book in your mind is your finest, going back over the catalogue of work you've done?
You mean before the books for Christ?
Mm.
In the earlier work, I would say the most important book was probably Memnoch the Devil, mm-hmm. because it was a book where I was desperately asking for answers and asking theological questions. And, of course, it ends sadly and tragically because I didn't have the answers yet. But I think it's the most rich of all the books that I wrote, and possibly the one that goes the farthest in knocking on the door and begging the Lord to let me back in, huh. even though I didn't know that's what I was doing when I did.
Yes, yes. I was going to ask you that, what those previous books actually said about you and who you were at the time, the themes and the ideas that you now see in them, what do they actually show about who you were?
Well, I think they show unhappiness. I think they show despair. I think they show the mind of a person who's become convinced that there is no God and that faith is not possible, and they show the darkness of that world, that darkness of that realm. And there's a protest going on in those books. Lestat and Louis and Armand, the vampire heroes and heroines in those books, they protest. They shake their fist at the night, and they say, we want to find some meaning. And it's me sort of having a fight with myself. I became convinced early on that God didn't exist and that faith was impossible, and those books are about rebellion. Hmm. I think that's why they appeal to so many young readers who are going through their rebellion against God right now, or their terrible rebellion against their parents or against their religion. I think they identify a lot with the characters in those books, and yes. I only hope that they'll come along with me to the new books, too.
Yes. Interview with a Vampire made you famous. Tom Cruise, Brad Pitt, Kirsten Dunst all starred in the movie. The meaning story to you is almost quite similar to what you've already outlined to some degree, isn't it?
It was, yeah. Interview with the Vampire is about the person giving up on God and giving up on faith and then suffering the consequences. A dark, dark descent into a hellish world where the only thing that can console him is physical beauty, you know. And I think they got it perfectly in the movie. I thought the movie captured the despair of the book and also the love of beauty that the characters have, what keeps them going in the book.
Mm. Interesting. I've been writing a lot and doing a lot of research recently on the context and the very issue of beauty. And I wonder whether God uses beauty when he can't get through to us in any other way to awaken us to the fact that in some way beauty reflects something of his very nature.
Oh, that's a wonderful thing you just said. I think that's exactly what happens. I think beauty is his way of telling us on the most basic level that he is here, that he made this world, that he made this universe. Why else would we be so sensitive to beauty? Why else would we cry at the sight of a beautiful tree caught in the wind and all of its limbs dancing in the wind. Why would we feel that if it wasn't for God?
Yes, I'm with you, absolutely with you. You said at one stage, if you had your time over again, you actually wouldn't use the word vampire. And yet you actually used it for a very specific reason, didn't you? It's got a very specific meaning for you in terms of metaphor.
Well, in 1976, when Interview with the Vampire was published, I felt it was a fairly clean word to use for a creature of the night, you know. But since that time, we've seen so much cheapening of the word. There's been so much popular vampire fiction written that people, they get the wrong impression about Interview with the Vampire. They got the wrong impression at the time. They dismissed the book and didn't realize that it was, in many respects, a metaphysical thriller. And so if I had it to do over again, I would probably use the word immortal. And it would be completely obvious to the reader that we're talking about a vampire immortal, but at least immortal would have more dignity to it. To me, the vampire was the perfect metaphor for the outcast, the perfect metaphor, because he looks human and sounds human and is partly human, and yet he's not human, and he can't dwell in the sunshine, and he can't really love, and he's going to outlive those he loves and has to watch them die. So it was the perfect metaphor for the person who has lost faith and lost any promise of eternity, and yet is doomed to go on in the darkness, looking, searching, hoping.
This is Open House right across Australia. Theopenhouse.net.au has the podcast of our feature interview with Anne Rice, well known for years as the dark supernatural story writer, now writing stories about Jesus. We'll get to that in just a minute. Anne, let's talk about your faith then. It moves very, very nicely on to the fact that you were searching back then when you were writing all these vampire books. You turned your back on your Catholic upbringing back in your teens. What was the catalyst for that? What was going on for you then?
Well, it happened to me in college. It was the first year of college, and I wanted to know all about the modern world, and I made the mistake of thinking that I couldn't talk to God about the doubts I had and the questions I had. I made the mistake of thinking that I had to abandon my religion to go out and discover what existentialism was and what the modern world really was. And I think it was the world more than anything else that led me away. You know, they say we fight the world, the flesh, and the devil. Mm. Well, with me, it was more the world than anything else.
And you were mentioning the doubts that you had. What kind of doubts did you have at the time, if you don't mind me prying?
Well, I was very young. We have to keep that in mind. I was 18. Mm. And so it was hard for me to understand how Christianity could be a true religion when there were so many billions and millions of people who had never heard of it. When you're very young, you jump to conclusions. You think, that means it's not true. That means it's all a facade. It's only as you get older that you realize that God solves these problems. Mm. He'll get to everybody. You know, He has His own way of reaching the millions who we think maybe have never heard His name. He has His own way of giving them their moment. I didn't realize that. I had been brought up very strictly Catholic in a very sheltered Catholic world, and suddenly I was out in the Protestant secular world, and my faith cracked. It was brittle. It was brittle, and it cracked, and I made the mistake of stopping my prayers. If I had just talked to God, if I had gone to Him and said, help me with this, you know, this is a terrible time of doubt, help me with this. But I really didn't do that so much as I just backed off from the dilemma and went to seek what I thought was the truth in the writings of the existentialists and the modern world.
Mm. Something else that you've also been quite public about is losing your daughter, Michelle, to leukemia back in 1972. She was just 5 years old. And for anybody, that would send, I think, any parent into a tailspin. How did it affect you in particular and your outlook on life?
Well, I think it greatly darkened my outlook on life. I was already an atheist. I didn't leave the church because of it, but it certainly wasn't something that was likely to encourage me to return. I never took it personally. You know, I feel that, you know, beautiful children die. This is one of the things that happens in a random world in which we live. But it certainly darkened my view and darkened my whole emotional approach to life, and that came out in Interview with the Vampire. I didn't realize it, but when I was writing about the child vampire Claudia and how she would never grow up, I was writing in my own way about my daughter without realizing it. I was putting things in symbolic terms.
Yeah, right. Have you seen that happen very much when you look back on your work and say, I didn't realize it, but that's what I was doing?
Oh, definitely. Definitely, because when I write, I'm not terribly conscious of the symbolic meaning of what I'm doing. I trust it is there. I get very wrapped up in my story, and I go for an authentic feeling, and I trust that the deeper meanings will be there. If you give everything to the book, if you really delve, if you really go for the pain and you go for the pleasure and you go for the absolute truth of what you know about anything, that book is going to have some depth to it. It's bound to happen. And so often I'm going back and looking at books and realizing now how much they are codes or allegories of what was going on in my life at the time.
Fascinating. Then Christopher was born to you and Stan, your husband then, 1978. He's now a successful author in himself, in his own right. His birth had quite an effect on you and your husband, didn't he?
Well, it did, because we were very heavy drinkers and we weren't facing it. And when Christopher came along, he really saved us. It was a gift from God, really, to have this child. And we both did something we thought was impossible. We quit drinking altogether. We just stopped in the summer of 1979, and we never drank again. And really, it was Christopher. It was looking at that child in the crib and thinking, well, we don't want him to have parents who are drunks.
Huh. So for you, Anne, when did you start questioning again? Here you've gone into atheism, you've kind of, you know, gone into a life of darkness, as you say in your own words. When did the question start to surface again in your mind and your heart, and you say, okay, I can't push this away any longer?
Well, it was the 1990s. I was back in New Orleans, and I was very successful as a writer. My books were number one bestsellers at that time. But the more I studied history, the more I read about the past, the more I kept asking myself, what was Christianity about? How did it start? How did it manage to take over the whole Roman Empire? How did that happen? How did the Jews manage to survive all these centuries? I began to be plagued by these questions, and I realized I was really obsessed with these questions because I had never stopped loving God. I had told myself I couldn't believe in him, but I had never stopped loving him. And I saw God everywhere that I looked. I saw him in history. And I think it was study and history and research that drew me back in a sort of active day-to-day way. But beneath that was an undercurrent, a yearning to return, a yearning to go back and to say, look, I'm not an atheist. This is all fake. I love you. I believe that you're there. I believe that you made us. I believe you made everything. And it was really the day I finally stopped asking the questions. And I thought, look, you've been obsessed with theological questions now for a couple of years. Why don't you just go back? He'll help you with this. And finally, there came that moment where I felt like I just turned to him and said, I want to come home.
Wow. Tell me about that moment. Where were you and what happened?
I was in my office, actually, in my house in New Orleans, and it was a Sunday afternoon, as I remember it. And I called downstairs to my assistant, Amy, who was a religion teacher. She worked on the weekends for me as a secretary. And I said, do you know a priest that I can go to see to go to confession, to go back? And she said, yes, I do. And she called back a few minutes later, and she said, he's there right now. And we got in the car, and we went. And I went to confession, about 2 hours of talking with this priest about everything, and I was accepted back into the Catholic Church. I was overjoyed. It was one of the happiest days of my life. Then I had to come home, of course, and tell my husband.
Well, I wanted to know how the family reacted.
Well, he reacted very well, as a matter of fact. I came home, and I told him, I said, I've gone back to the Catholic Church, and this means we have to be married in the Catholic Church. And to my utter amazement, he said, fine, I'll do it. And I hadn't expected that. I hadn't known what to expect because he was an atheist all his life. And, you know, he was a rather intellectual atheist, just as I'd been an intellectual agnostic. And I was afraid he was going to rebel, but he didn't. He had great respect for the ceremony and for my desire to do it, and he was completely willing, and we were married within a week. in my parish church where I'd grown up. It was a wonderful, wonderful, wonderful experience. Mm.
This is Open House. Anne Rice is our special guest. The openhouse.net.au has the podcast. Okay, Anne, now tell me about that day in 2002. You're sitting in church, you're praying, and you decide to give your whole writing over to Jesus Christ. Tell me about that moment.
Well, it was a Saturday afternoon, and it was right before Mass, and I was sitting there, and I was doing what I would call negotiating with the Lord. I was saying, Lord, I'm yours. I believe in you. I believe in you completely, but I've got to write these vampire novels. I have a lot of people dependent on me. This writing is really for you, Lord, but it's convoluted and difficult. And suddenly, it hit me. It hit me. If I didn't have the courage to be Mother Teresa, if I didn't have the courage to give away all I possessed and go follow him, I could give him all that I did. I could give him all my work. I could just say, from this moment forward, everything I write will be for you. And I did say that. Hmm. And I walked out of the church feeling really like I had no sense of how great a moment it had been. It was only as the days began to pass and I began to reflect on it and get deeper and deeper into my research to write the life of Jesus that I realized that it was the greatest turning point in my life. Huh. I was never going to write anything again that didn't reflect my faith in Christ, my belief in him. You know, it was just quite an incredible experience. Mm.
Well, you followed that commitment through quite literally with the Christ the Lord series of books, first Out of Egypt and then more recently The Road to Cana, which I read just a little bit from before.
Yes.
What value is there in fictionalizing Jesus' life? That's what you've done, and with such beauty and with such craft. What value do you think there is in the very form of what you've done?
Well, I think the value is to tell the story, to reach somebody with that story who has not yet been reached. I think every time we tell the story, whether we stand on a street corner and testify or whether we stand up in church and testify, when we tell that story over again, the story of faith, the story of Jesus, the story of Jesus' life, we may reach some person who for some reason could not hear it in any other way. You never know. I mean, little things people said to me helped me to go back to Jesus, things that they probably never even thought about. And so the whole hope of the book is to reach somebody new, to reach somebody whom nobody else has reached with the life of Jesus, with the story, so that maybe they'll pick up the Bible, maybe they'll turn to Christ, maybe they'll think for the first time in their lives, they'll think, well, maybe he's real, maybe he really did come down here and walk this earth for over 33 years. Maybe he did die on the cross for us. Maybe I'm wrong. Maybe he really did do that. And that's what these books are meant to do. They're meant to present him in a hyper-realistic novel in a way that draws you in just as you would be drawn into any novel. And the hope is you'll find yourself completely believing in him and wanting to know more about him.
Cara Martin, our book reviewer here at Open House, actually said of The Road to Cana, I quote, "Anne Rice makes you realize how much of our Jesus may be more ritual and stained glass window than biblical." I think there's a real, Jesus' divinity comes through, but Jesus' humanity too, as in the mystery of what we call the incarnation, isn't it? That God himself actually was in human form in the person of Jesus. And that humanity comes out a lot, I think, in the novels.
I think that's my vocation, is to make that humanity real while never diminishing the divinity. To always remember that Jesus is God and man. He is divine and human. But I think it's my vocation to bring out that humanity, to make people think, I hope, in these books a little bit more about what it meant. The mystery of the incarnation, as you said, this incredible love story that Almighty God, the maker of the universe, the maker of the Big Bang, the maker of everything, actually became a man and lived on this earth for over 33 years.
In Out of Egypt, you explore in fictional form what Jesus' childhood might be like, and you have some lovely little creative flourishes in there, like he was making live sparrows out of lumps of clay and
yes,
stopping a rainstorm and things like that. And then similar things actually happen in The Road to Cana. In fact, in The Road to Cana, you even introduce a love interest into Jesus' life. Now, of course, for some people, they go, oh, hang on a sec. Well, now you're getting beyond the biblical story. Where does creative license go? What are the boundaries of creative license when it comes to, particularly, say, writing about Jesus' life?
Well, truly, really the boundary is the Bible. And we have no evidence that Jesus was married, and we have no evidence that he was anything but sinless. I mean, this is our doctrine. Jesus is sinless, and he wasn't married. So I had to present him as a man who was confronted with temptations just like every other man. You know, he was a full-blooded man, and he is celibate, and he's living alone in a society where this is just not accepted. A man is expected to get married. Mm-hmm. He's not accepted. He's not respected. And I wanted to show the pressure he was under, and I wanted to answer the Da Vinci Code. I wanted to say, look at this picture. Let me show you how it might have been for him as a man who did not marry and did not commit sin.
Yes. Was there a part of Jesus' life when you were writing it that you were particularly awestruck by?
Oh, I'm awestruck by all of it. I'm awestruck by the fact that he was one of us, what he went through, what he endured from other people. You know, just every day that I pick up the New Testament and read it, I'm amazed again by something in the Gospels. I mean, one of the reasons that I'm taking my time in writing the third book about the ministry of Jesus is because I'm so astonished by the things that happened, by the different miracles, by the different reports. I mean, everything about it, just his love for us, his incredible love for us, his patience with us. This is so overwhelming to me. It's so magnificent. I mean, this is a God who came down and became one of us, and right now in heaven, he has a human body.
Yeah.
He ascended into heaven, you know, body and soul, and this is absolutely overwhelmingly beautiful to me. It's the most beautiful love story I have ever heard in anywhere, in any religion or in any body of mythology or anything. It is the love story of our God sending his only begotten Son to live with us and be with us, to be one of us.
Yes. And you've gone to great lengths to make it clear that even though you've had your Christian conversion, it doesn't mean that you've renounced your previous works, your previous vampire novels. What value do you see in, I guess, quote-unquote, dark tales, like those that you used to write?
Well, I think that those stories are sincere, you know, mirrors of the quest for God. I think, like many dark stories, they're transformative. You go through the darkness and you come out with something affirmative, finally. I can't turn my back on them, and I can't renounce them. But, you know, at the same time, I understand if my new readers don't want to read them. I just can't say that they're bad books. I don't believe they are. I think dark tales and dark stories have tremendous power. I think Moby Dick is a dark story. A Christmas Carol by Dickens is a dark story. Nathaniel Hawthorne's short story Good Man Brown is a dark story. There are many dark stories that are essentially about goodness, and I hope that those vampire novels are in their own way about the search for the light.
Yes, yes. So you've got the third book in the... Is it going to be a trilogy, or is it going to be longer than that?
I think it's going to be a quartet. I think there'll be a third and fourth book, but I've also have a memoir coming out called Called Out of Darkness, and I'm also experimenting with doing some other kinds of Christian fiction. I'm not ready yet to talk about the details, but I'd like to do a whole variety of types of Christian writing. I'd love to write a big first century novel about the Christians and the Romans, you know, my version of the robe and Quo Vadis. I'd love to do that. I'd love to write some metaphysical novels like the Vampire Chronicles, only about angels, you know, angels and their activity. But all of this must be Christian writing, and it must be for Christ, or I can't do it.
Yes. Well, it has been thoroughly enjoyable to talk to you, Anne. I really do appreciate your time at Open House. Thanks so much.
Well, thank you very much. It's been a great pleasure.
That's Anne Rice there, the author, 28 books and counting, most recently the Christ the Lord series. AnneRice.com for more.
We hope you enjoy this Open House podcast. To hear more from Open House, visit theopenhouse.net.au.